Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Without the action-inspiring poverty of Africa or the explosive economic growth of China and India, where does Latin America fall in the spectrum of the developing world? While many observers still point to the region's unstable governments, rampant drug crime, and large undereducated populations as reasons it will never fully succeed, the reality of 21st century Latin America is quite different. Notwithstanding Hugo Chavez's populist claims over oil-soaked Venezuela, true democratic governments are flourishing today in Mexico, Brazil, Chile, and other countries that just decades ago seemed doomed to subsist under dictatorial leadership forever. So what else does Latin America need, and how does its relative success change global political and economic conditions? Michael Reed is America's editor for The Economist. His new book is called Forgotten Continent, The Battle for Latin America's Soul. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Latin America has had its critics on the left and also on the right, and they have had really different assumptions about the sources of its problems. Can you talk about that?
That's right. I mean, I think because for so long Latin America seemed to do so relatively poorly, particularly compared with the United States, for much of the past two centuries, there's been an almost obsessive debate about the causes for that relative failure. On the left, people came up with a notion known as dependency theory, that Latin America's problem was because it was a producer of raw materials and assigned a subordinate status in the world economy and subject to American intervention, a victim of American intervention. On the right, conservatives tended to see it as a victim of Iberian culture, which was held to be inimical to democracy, individualism, and thus to successful capitalism. In the book, I argue that it's a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, you know, that dichotomy of opinion alone is a really powerful thing. What should that tell us about the complexity of Latin America and its relative weaknesses and strengths?
Well, as I said, I think it's this debate became almost obsessive because the region has so often flattered to deceive. I mean, if you went back to a century ago, countries like Argentina were one of the 10 richest countries in the world, and Latin America as a whole was attracting the kind of excitement in Europe or the United States that is now reserved for China or India. Again, in after the Second World War, things seemed to be going well. And yet so often there was this pendulum between democracy and dictatorship and between economic boom and bust.
What's the legacy of the United Fruit debacle in Guatemala?
I think it was very serious. I mean, in my book, I generally disagree with the view that the United States has been responsible for everything that went wrong in Latin America. I think countries have to take a much closer look at themselves. But I think the one incident on which the United States clearly was guilty of overthrowing a promising democracy was Guatemala in 1954. It was done in the name of anti-communism, yet the government that was overthrown was a reforming democratic government that was trying to do land reform and the other kind of democratic reforms that, had they happened 10 years earlier under Roosevelt and the Four Freedoms and so on, or 10 years later under Kennedy and the Alliance for Progress, the United States would have welcomed.
What did the United States learn a lesson from the failure there in Guatemala?
I don't think it did. I think rather the left learned a lesson, and it learned a tragic lesson. In Guatemala in 1954, there was a young Argentine doctor who was visiting there by the name of Ernesto Guevara, who, of course, later became famous as Che Guevara at Fidel Castro's side in Cuba. And the lesson that Guevara and Castro derived from Guatemala in 1954 was they couldn't afford democracy because that might be overthrown by the United States.
We've been hearing this morning and throughout the week about Hugo Chavez threatening to stop selling oil to the United States if ExxonMobil moves ahead with legal proceedings against Venezuela. Can you talk about the chances that that he would carry through with those threats?
I think it's highly unlikely. It's not the first time he's threatened this. He's done it regularly. If he were to carry it out, the cost to Venezuela would be much greater than the cost to the United States. Remember that Venezuela's oil, most of it is very heavy crude, sulfurous, and can only be refined in refineries belonging to Citgo, the Venezuelan-owned company, that are adapted for that in the United States. In the medium term, Venezuela could get other buyers, no doubt, but in the short term, that would be very hard. And this occurs at a moment when the Venezuelan economy is under great strain, and there are clear signs that that the state oil company is starting to run out of cash.
What would happen in Venezuela if the price of oil dropped? There are strains right now, even with the price as high as it is.
I think it will face a terrible reckoning. I mean, Chavez has been spending for years like there was no tomorrow. He's made the economy even more dependent on oil than it was before. Private investment has been hit by political uncertainty, by his constant threats against private property, even if they're often not carried out. Instead of saving part of this massive oil windfall, which would have been the wise thing to do, precisely so that the government could then increase spending when there's a downturn, he's been spending it. And imports have been surging in Venezuela. Venezuela now imports nearly all of its food, which is crazy in a country with so much agricultural land. So I think if the oil price were to fall in a significant way, then Venezuela and Hugo Chavez are going to face great difficulties.
So he was not made president for life. There are other signs as well that his leadership certainly is weakening. I'm wondering, Michael, which you think is more important ultimately for the future of Venezuela? Is it the individual who would replace Chavez or the manner in which he might be replaced?
I think it's terribly important, the manner in which he is replaced. I mean, the result of the referendum in December, when his plans to change the constitution in a semi-totalitarian direction, the defeat of that referendum was enormously significant for Venezuela and for Latin America as a whole. And I think what it showed is, firstly, increasing disillusion amongst many of his own supporters. I mean, some 3 million of his own supporters who had voted for him only a year before in the presidential election stayed away this time because of problems of inflation, corruption, incompetence, etc. That on the one hand, and on the other hand, I think it shows the residual strength of democratic culture in Venezuela. Despite the polarization, I think most Venezuelans do not want their country to become a dictatorship, and I think they want a peaceful, democratic transfer of power when Chavez's term ends in 2012.
You mentioned that Chavez has been spending money that could have been banked and should have been banked, perhaps, for what we'd call a rainy day. And there are other countries throughout Latin America that have, in fact, been doing just that.
That's right. I mean, Chile is the outstanding example, which Chile's main export is copper. The price of copper has been very high as well. It's been saving a significant chunk of those windfall earnings in funds that the government can spend if the economy moves into slower growth or a recession. To a lesser extent, other countries around the region have been using the commodity bonanza of the last few years to strengthen their public finances, to pay down debt, so that they will be better placed than they have been in the past. And that's one reason why so far, and it's obviously early days yet, but so far, the kind of investor panic that we've seen with the credit crunch in the United States and Europe has not yet hit Latin America in a significant way.
We talked about the credit crunch in the United States, and clearly one key crisis in Latin America was the credit problem in the early 80s. Can you talk about what has changed since then to really stabilize the economic base?
Yes, in 1982, beginning with Mexico's debt default, in essence, Latin America went bankrupt, and that forced a series of economic changes, massive economic changes, which were traumatic but necessary in large part towards the creation of open market economies, and with inflation, which has been a chronic problem in Latin America, finally tamed. I mean, nowadays, economic management in most countries in the region is highly professional, its fiscal policy is much more responsible than it used to be. I mean, traditionally, Latin American governments have been spendthrift, and that was a main reason for inflation. Nowadays, in most countries, inflation is in the low single digits. It's obviously spiking up just a little bit at the moment, as it is everywhere in the world because of food prices and oil prices. But in most countries, it's between 3 and 5% a year. I mean, that's just a big change from the past. And from this economic stability is flowing a lot of benefits in terms of the return of credit. People in Latin America can get mortgages again, for example, for the first time in a generation, and individuals and companies can start making much longer term decisions rather than not knowing what's going to happen from one year to the next.
To what extent do you think that U.S. policy toward Latin America is still somewhat shaped by sort of Cold War perceptions of the communist threat and things that simply don't exist anymore?
I think that's certainly true of policy towards Cuba. But Cuba apart, I think that's not really the problem. I mean, ironically, perhaps, in view of the past, when Latin Americans often complained about what they saw as the United States meddling in Latin America. In the last few years, there have been a lot of complaints that the U.S. has neglected the region. Now, on the whole, I think, you know, that neglect, to the extent that it's existed, has been benign neglect. But there are three issues on which I think three issues in particular on which the region would benefit from closer engagement from the United States. One is trade. The second is drugs, and the third is migration. And one might add, for some of the poorer countries in the region, like some of the Central American countries, I mean, more aid would be helpful as well.
When you talk about the drug issue, the U.S. certainly has had some involvement, but it's mostly been in an effort to keep drugs out of this country. What else could be done in Latin America for the benefit of those countries simply to stabilize what's taking place?
Well, the United States is obviously no longer the only significant market for cocaine in the world. I mean, consumption in Britain, in Europe, in parts of Asia, and in Latin America itself is now significant. But demand on a large scale began in the United States. It's still the biggest market. And after 30 years, you know, prohibition of cocaine has failed to stop its consumption, and it's falling only very slowly. Now, the result of cocaine's illegality is that huge amounts of money and power are now commanded by organized criminal syndicates in Latin America, and tackling them is a huge task for still relatively fragile democratic states.
Michael Reed is our guest. He's America's editor for The Economist. His new book is called Forgotten Continent, The Battle for Latin America's Soul. After the break, we'll talk about the relationship between the U.S., Latin America, and the EU, and also compare those to the relationships that Latin America has with China and India. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
You're listening listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michael Reed. He is America's editor for The Economist, and his new book is called Forgotten Continent, The Battle for Latin America's Soul. If you'd like to join us today, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Characterize the differences between the relationships that exist between the U.S. and Latin America and the EU and Latin America.
Well, I think if Latin Americans sometimes complain of neglect by the U.S., I think that applies even more to the EU, except in one way. The further south you go in Latin America, the more that trade relations tend to be there are diversified. And in countries like Brazil and Argentina, exports to the EU and investment from the EU tends to be bigger than with the United States. But Latin American politicians often feel that they have more in common with Europe than with the United States. I mean, I think that's debatable, but in general, the EU has been so wrapped up with its own internal arguments and debates, and with its own region, with its own expansion, that it really pays, I would say, less attention to Latin America than the United States does, with the one exception of Spain.
Do you think some of that sense of having things in common has to do with colonialism?
I think that's one element of it. Yes, that's true. I mean, the history of colonialism. I mean, the shared language with the Iberian Peninsula, a shared, to a certain extent, some shared kind of political characteristics. I mean, you've had social democratic and Christian democratic parties in Latin America as in Europe. But on the other hand, I think there are a lot of specific Latin American elements in the political culture, notably populism, which I talk about a lot in the book. And I think there are also a lot of commonalities between Latin America and the United States in terms of history and culture too, and the sense of space there is in the Americas compared with Europe.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Michael Reed. His new book is called Forgotten Continent, The Battle for Latin America's Soul. Let's speak first to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Good afternoon, Chris and Michael. NAFTA and CAFTA notwithstanding, Michael, do you see a more robust opportunity for in the United States-Mexico economic zone, a la the European Union, with much more cultural and economic barriers reduced for cultural and economic traffic, not necessarily a political union, of course, but simply it seems an obvious thing culturally, historically, and economically, but knowing that the income disparity is so great between the two countries now, it seems a lot of problems could be solved. And I thought President Bush was going to take this on with his ambassador to Mexico when he first came into office, but it seems to never materialize.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, NAFTA has really achieved all that could be reasonably expected of it in terms of boosting trade links between Mexico and the United States, boosting foreign investment in Mexico. And although it would be good if growth was faster in Mexico at the moment, all in all, it hasn't been too bad over the last decade, and I think NAFTA's played a big part in that. One hopes the same process will start in Central America. I mean, I do think there would be great benefits for both for the United States, for Mexico, and for Central America if steps are taken to build on NAFTA and deepen the relationship of economic cooperation. Because, I mean, the example of the European Union does show that, I mean, the one thing, I mean, even Eurosceptics, as they're called in my country, would have to accept, in which Europe has been a success, has been its extension of democracy and development to the European periphery, first in southern Europe and then in eastern Europe. There really is a chance to do something similar, I think, with Mexico and Central America.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Can you talk about the relationships that are forming and have existed, but certainly as they exist today, between Latin America and places like China and India?
Yes, they're becoming increasingly important, though perhaps not as important as some of the politicians in Latin America have claimed. I mean, so far the main impact of the industrialization of China on Latin America has been through the channel of commodity prices. The high levels of commodity prices in the last few years owe an awful lot to Chinese demand, and they have been important in the much better rates of economic growth in the last 4 or 5 years, in which Latin America has grown on average about 5% a year. There has been some Chinese investment in commodities, in mines and so forth, but much less than in Africa, because it's a much more crowded market in Latin America with American companies, European companies, and Latin American companies all active. I think it's also been a matter of concern, particularly in Mexico and Central America, that can their maquiladora assembly plants and manufacturing plants compete with China? Well, some did move to China a few years ago, but what's happened in Mexico is that the manufacturing's grown again quite strongly in the last few years on the basis of greater efficiency, more added value, and specialization in industries where location and closeness to the United States and integration in a North American production chain is really important.
I know there's a huge demand for example, South American soybeans from China. Can you talk about the agricultural sector and how the growth in Asia has really affected the kinds of things that are produced and traded from Latin America?
Well, certainly soybeans, exports of soybeans and maize and so on have been have benefited enormously from Chinese demand, because as people get less poor in China, they tend to eat more meat, and so there's greater demand for animal feed. But in general, South America and Latin America have the potential to export an awful lot more food to the world, because there's a lot of land in relation to people. Climatic conditions are in many parts are very good, and agriculture is very efficient. And the space to do all that without touching the rainforest, although in practice there has been a conflict between the preservation of the rainforest and the expansion of soya. I mean, what the main barrier is agricultural protectionism in the United States and in Europe. In future, as we're seeing some signs of food scarcity, I think that that's going to be an area in which Latin America is going to be terribly important for the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number, or you can email think@kera.org. Let's go next to Gary in Richardson. Hi, Gary.
Good afternoon. I'd like to ask a question regarding the actual economic structures with respect to oligarchies across, it seems like, a lot of Latin America. It seems like that diminishes the opportunity for development of a sound middle class, which would give a lot more success, and that then emanates tentacles through other issues like immigration, and people aren't coming up here for their goodwill, they're coming up here because there's economic opportunity. What would be your perspective about that type of economic opportunity developing across Latin America? And is that something that's even possible, even with democratic structures? It's going to take significant changes, it would seem, in the laws in certain countries. And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I think that's a very good point, Gary. I mean, I think it partly depends where you are in Latin America. I think a country like Brazil has a very large and diverse business class. If you're in a small country in Central America, then perhaps a rather sort of tight, closed oligarchy will be more powerful and have a there'll be more confusion between business interests and politics. I mean, the one country where I think what you would call in the United States, competition policy, I mean, where you need a tougher competition law against monopolies, is Mexico. Now, I think the current president, Felipe Calderon, is entirely conscious of the need for more reform in that area. I think he's feeling his way cautiously to make sure that he gets it right when he does it. But in general, I would say, compared with 20 or 30 years ago, you're seeing a lot of new business groups in the region, and the sort of picture of Latin American countries as being run by a very tight-knit oligarchy is becoming more and more outdated in many places in the region.
You spoke earlier, Michael, about the fact that you think the U.S. needs to pay more attention to migration policy. In this country, when people talk about getting a handle on immigration, it means sort of stopping the flow of illegal immigrants across the border. It's clear, though, that places, particularly Mexico, but places throughout Latin America, really depend upon the remittances that are now huge portions of the economies in both Mexico and parts of Central America. What happens if somehow U.S. policy prevents any more immigration and in fact causes some of the amount of money being sent back to contract?
Well, it obviously causes a problem. I mean, I think migration has been the big increase in migration in the last 20 years has been partly a result of demographics, both in south of the border and north of the border. It's partly been because the 1980s and 1990s were quite tough in many parts of Latin America, but because the demographic factors mean that within the next 10 or 15 years, you would tend to get fewer migrants going north anyway. And in the last few years, you've actually seen quite encouraging job growth in both Mexico and Brazil and in other countries in the region, which, if it's sustained, would also mean there'd be less migration. But obviously remittances have are a very important source of foreign exchange and indeed poverty relief, particularly in Mexico and Central America, and in a country like Ecuador and Bolivia, for example, where it tends to be migrants who've gone to Spain who send the money back, whereas in Mexico and Central America, it comes from the United States.
Could it be argued that without that migration and without those remittances, that the stabilization economically in those countries wouldn't have taken place over the past two, three decades?
I think there certainly would have been more political instability. I think it has been an important safety valve, if you like, but it's obviously also been an important factor in economic growth in the United States.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Casey in Cleburne. Hi, Casey.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question for your guest. Earlier, you seemed to be advocating more free trade between America or the United States and Central America, much like NAFTA has done for the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And I was wondering if you had any concerns over a country like Colombia, where people's right to organize trade unions has been suppressed by violence and assassination so long, and the effect that would have on Americans competing for those jobs, as well as the human rights effects in their own country. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's an important point. I mean, if you look at the situation in Colombia, there is far less violence today than there was 20 years ago, or there was indeed 10 years ago. Trade unionists have been caught up in that violence, just of Colombians, just as Colombians of all kinds have been. There have been, you know, some cases which are obviously appalling, where it appears to have been the case that trade unionists have been targeted for their trade union activities by, for example, paramilitary groups in the past. Very few, if any, of those cases today, and the government has made a big effort both to protect trade union leaders and to prosecute those who are responsible for such killings. But I think the more important point is that you know, where does this violence come from? This violence basically comes from the existence of on a large scale over 20 years of the drug trade and of the organized criminal groups, both of the right and of the left, that have grown up around that. And, you know, so how in the medium term are you going to deal with this problem? I think the best way is by encouraging the growth of the legal economy, and that in turn will strengthen the democratic state in Colombia and increase its ability to protect trade unions. So I think the approval of the free trade agreement, while I understand the risks that you're talking about, I think it offers by far the best way to ensure that trade unionists are protected in the future in Colombia. Because if it's not approved, the message is that the legal economy will grow less fast because trade will be diverted to neighboring countries that do have free trade agreements with the United States. And meanwhile, the cocaine business will carry on as normal.
Michael Reed is my guest. He's America's editor for The Economist, and his new book is called Forgotten Continent, The Battle for Latin America's Soul. We'll return to our conversation with Michael after a quick break. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. In a few minutes, we will talk more about Latin America, and we'll talk about the impact of either racial tolerance or racism on the economy in Latin America.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest today, joining us from the studios of The Economist in London, is Michael Reed. He is America's editor for the publication, and he's got a new book out called Forgotten Continent, The Battle for Latin America's Soul. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Michael, can you talk about the impact that attitudes toward particularly indigenous populations in Latin America have on internal stability and also on their ability to sort of operate in the global marketplace?
Yes, I mean, I think that clearly, because of its history, there has been discrimination against indigenous people historically in several countries in Latin America, and they tend to be disproportionately poor and disproportionately to lack services and education and so on. I think one of the things that's, you know, happening in the region and as a result of democracy that's been happening over the past 20 years or so is that that's starting to change. I mean, in countries like Bolivia and Ecuador, you've seen movements of indigenous people who are demanding greater political participation and a fairer deal. I think sometimes those movements have taken the form of forms which are slightly ambivalent in relation to democracy. I mean, in Bolivia and Ecuador, they've overthrown presidents and so on. But I think in the long run, it's important that obviously that if democracy is to work in Latin America, everybody's got to be given a fair chance.
1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number. Up next is Alfred on the line in Mesquite. Hi, Alfred.
Good afternoon. My question is, given the development in the Amazon Basin with agriculture, lumbering, things like that, maybe even housing, I'm not sure, what do you think the economic progress will have on the climate change issue, given that the Amazon Basin is a key rainforest and resource for keeping climate under control?
Because I mean, climate change is a crucial issue for Latin America because it's going to be greatly affected by it, and also because what happens in Latin America is going to have an effect on the world as a whole, particularly in relation to the rainforest. I mean, the Amazon rainforest is a vast place, and in Brazil, something like 16 to 20 million people live in it. I think it's impossible for all of it to remain as forest, just as, there used to be a lot of forests in the United States that are not there, or in Britain, that are not there anymore. But that said, clearly it's vital for Brazil and for the world and for climate in the region as a whole that as much as possible of it should be preserved. And that, I think, is partly a matter of better enforcement in Brazil of the law against illegal logging and against illegal destruction of the forest. And I think it's partly a global matter. And, you know, Brazil has now come round to the view that within the framework of the UN climate change talks, that it's a global responsibility to preserve rainforests, and that requires finding ways for to pay so that the standing forest has greater value than cleared forest.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Nathan in Dallas. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I recently subscribed to The Economist because they have such great international coverage, but I noticed something reading it, and I was just wondering if your guest could help explain how it came about that free trade is the driving principle for that newspaper.
Well, thanks for the question, Nathan. It came about because The Economist was actually founded in 1843 to campaign for the repeal of the Corn Laws. The Corn Laws were a law in Britain that protected farmers and meant that food prices in the cities, which were growing then as part of the Industrial Revolution, were kept artificially high. And ever since then, the magazine has subscribed to the principle that free trade is important for economic development and for growing prosperity.
How much progress can be made in Latin America? Could in 50 years Latin America have moved fully beyond the sort of developing world status?
I think certainly some countries in the region can do that much quicker. I would expect Chile, for example, to have achieved developed status within 10 to 15 years. I think, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in the world economy over the next couple of years. We don't know quite how bad things will get. But with, you know, reasonable conditions in the world, I certainly think that countries like Brazil, Mexico, as well as Chile, will be, you know, well on the path to developed country status within a couple of decades, and I would expect Peru and Colombia, with a bit more hesitation, but I think they're on the right track, but they've got a long way to go.
Are the countries of Latin America more likely to sort of pull each other along in terms of economics than they are in terms of democratic reforms, or do those things ultimately move sort of hand in hand?
That's a very interesting question. And if you look at the history of the region, there have been periods in which things have happened in a very synchronized fashion. For example, the political independence, the abolition of slavery in the mid-19th century, liberal reforms which reduced the power of the church in the same period. After the Wall Street crash, there was a move away from civilian government towards dictatorships in many countries across the region. Again, in 1982, in the 1980s, there was this wave of democratization and economic reform. I think at the moment, this is a period in which countries are going in slightly different directions. I mean, I think in the book, I argue those countries I've mentioned, Chile, Brazil, Mexico, Peru, Colombia, are pursuing a path of what I've called democratic reformism. I mean, some of them have nominally left-of-center governments, others have nominally right-of-center governments, but they're going down a path of consensual democratic reform. And then you've got another group headed by Venezuela, which Chavez represents what I call in the book populist autocracy, which is a phenomenon which has a history in Latin America. You think of people like Perón in Argentina and so on. Now, in terms of integration, I think Brazil has a very important role to play in South America. But integration will only happen when governments and societies are really prepared to make the kind of decisions to make it work and not just talk about it.
Is the importance of Brazil's role as much because it has more shared borders than any other state in South America?
It's partly. It's partly just because of its sheer economic weight. I mean, Brazil accounts for, what, about 40% of Latin America's GDP. It's the one country in the region that is, I think, rightly mentioned as a regional power and as a country of global significance for the next few decades, both because of its importance, its economic importance, but also because of its importance in environmental negotiations. I mean, the question the last caller raised.
1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next to Jimmy in Dallas. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi. I have a question in regards. I was reading in the Times this morning about Arizona, who is tightening up their laws, and I presume that all states eventually will be tightening up their undocumented or illegal alien statuses for folks, and driving a lot of that dynamic out of the state. My question was, and they also made a mention about even legal immigrants were considering moving back to Mexico. What would the or other Latin American countries? What would the dynamics be of countries, Latin American countries, receiving these legal immigrants back to their home countries and finding the jobs to be able to supply for them? I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think it's going to be a real double whammy for Mexico because of NAFTA. Mexico's economy is now very closely integrated with that of the United States. Mexican economic growth tends to move with U.S. industrial production. Now, if the U.S. is going to go into a recession and you also have migrants returning, it's going to be a tough period for Mexico. I mean, I think compared with 20 years ago or 10 years ago even, I think Mexico's both its economy and its democracy is more robust than they were in the past, but it's going to be it's going to be hard if that happens.
Michael, having talked about Latin America as the forgotten continent, can you talk about why you think that is, that the rest of the world, the developed world, has really not paid sufficient attention to what was taking place there, particularly the positive changes?
Well, Chris, I think as you hinted in your introduction to the program, I think it's partly just a matter of priorities. Since 9/11, for the United States and for Europe, I mean, parts of the Islamic world have been of overriding strategic concern. On the one hand, on the other hand, China and India, as you mentioned, have been growing so explosively, and Africa, on the other hand, its poverty and its wars kind of prick the conscience of the world. And so, Latin America is neither growing fast enough until recently, nor is it poor enough, nor is it dangerous enough to excite that kind of attention. I think the other thing is that Hugo Chavez is so voluble that he tends to grab all the headlines. And I think the real story in the region is actually not Venezuela. The real story in the region over the last 10 to 15 years has been one of achieving economic stability and now growth on a much more sustainable basis than in the past, and achieving democracies which, while clearly still having many flaws, are much stronger than they were in the past in many countries, and which is starting to allow some of the social problems which remain very urgent in the region, they're starting to be tackled.
So assuming that we all vow to begin paying an appropriate amount of attention to Latin America, what would you consider the most important indicators moving forward of how the individual states in Latin America are faring and then how it's doing as a whole on a global scale?
I would say look at some of the educational scores. Although I'm cautiously optimistic about the region, I highlighted some of the problems in the book, which I think the region must tackle. One of those is the appallingly low quality of public education. Now, there are these international tests of education that countries around the world take part in, and the Latin American countries tend to sit near the bottom of the class. I think it's important to watch those indicators over the years and to see if they start moving up. I think another thing that it's important to watch for is the murder rate. Another big problem in Latin America is the prevalence of violent crime, partly related to the drug trade, but not entirely. It's partly also related to the lack of effectiveness of police forces and judiciaries and so on. Now, some parts of the region, such as Colombia, such as Sao Paulo, you're seeing murder rates fall quite steeply. If that starts happening more widely, that'll be a great trend.
Michael Reed joined us from the London studios of The Economist, where he is America's editor. His new book is called Forgotten Continent, The Battle for Latin America's Soul. Michael, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.